Okay, today is Monday, October 16th, 2017, and we have a few good weeks of serious study now till we're interrupted again by the holidays. And we're at a very interesting juncture. We left off last week. Again, I mentioned there had been this convention of the Zionist movement in Boston. Many Rabbanim were there. And the talk began, obviously they were speaking about it before, but now they were together and they now become serious and they send out invitations for July 1902. Whoever is interested, we're going to get together in New York and discuss organizing an Agudat HaRabbanim. Now, I just want to mention, it's interesting, I threw out something last week which to me is Zil Kri Berafu, axiomatic. And you can't imagine how many comments I got from people. And you see, when you study Torah history, every history for that matter, but Torah history is my concern, you have to put yourself into the framework of the time. You can't be anachronistic and take today's element and put it 115 years ago. At that time, everyone was a Zionist. People were shocked. Everyone was a Zionist. Yeah, I said that. Chaim Isaac Wyszynski had, like I told you, his cousin, who was in Omaha, Nebraska. He reportedly, this is what I heard from people who yet knew him, he made it clear already in an early stage in the 1920s that he is not a Zionist. He's listening to his cousin. But in America, everyone was a Zionist, plain and simple. The people, the Rabbanim, the idea, the return to Tzion. And again, you'll say, well, in Europe, not everyone was a Zionist. Well, the atmosphere was split in Europe. But you have to know that even in Volozhin, there was a closet Zionist movement, or even more than a closet. The Netziv identified with the Chovev Beit Zion. Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, Rabbi Moshe Mordechai Epstein came in Aliyah, moved Hebron Yeshiva to Israel. All right, it may not be formal Herzlian Zionism, but it certainly shows you the aura, the atmosphere. And in America, where everyone, they emigrated anyway, and what I said last week is very important. The Rabbanim weren't that stupid. They're fighting a battle with Shmirat Shabbat, with Kashrut, as we will see. At least if they go to Eretz Yisrael, with all the problems there, the chances are that the atmosphere will be better. But everyone was involved, all the great Rabbanim, Ramaz, and Leventhal, and right down the line. Someone asked me, what about Rav Lezer Silva? Well, first of all, Reb Lezer Silva in 1902 was not on the scene yet. He was a kid in Europe. But by the time he comes on the scene, Reb Lezer Silva himself, I quote him in the Silva era, Agudat Yisrael is my older sister and Mizrahi is my younger sister. It wasn't what happened after World War II. See, they attempted to organize Agudat Yisrael in America in 1922. It didn't take off. 1937, Reb Lezer Silva already is Rabbi Silva, Harav Silva, from Cincinnati, and he goes to the Knesiyah Gedola in Marienbad, and he goes to see his Rebbeim, and he goes to see Reb Chaim Moshe. He had learned in the Kollel, in the kibbutz it was called, the Reb Chaim Moshe in Vilna, and Reb Chaim Moshe said to him, my dear Talmud, it's a druch tzimi ois, asn't af grindin an agudat Yisrael in America. It appears to me that we should organize an agudat Yisrael in America. So we came back to America, and Reb Lezer Silva immediately got Rav Soloveitchik involved, and agudat Yisrael was organized. But then you had people you could talk to. The immigrants are starting to come. The Rebbeim are starting to come. The Rosh Yeshiva are starting to come. 38, 39, 40, the whole American scene changes. You all know that today, if you read Art Scroll, there was no Yiddishkeit in America before the immigrants who came in the 40s. Yiddishkeit begins with Mr. Mendelovich. Well, it's not true. There was Yiddishkeit. There was, you take Rabbi Revel, I mean, this man was the first one to dig in the soil and do something. But halacha lemaisa, Before World War II, you could yell Agudat Yisrael from today to tomorrow. You had no one to yell it to. After the late 30s, there's a new world. And then, of course, there's the Satmar Rav, there's Rabbi Aaron Cutler, and there's a sea change in the whole atmosphere. That today, Mizrahi is nothing in America, and Agudat Yisrael rules. It's like the OU. I don't know who's more important. You can debate it from today to tomorrow. Both of them have offices in Washington and deal with the politicians. But there are many factors involved. Agudat Yisrael reproduced itself in America. The Mizrahi was so successful that those who would have headed the Mizrahi in America all went in Aliyah. They disappeared from the American scene. And you all know in YU until today, people will mourn. People, serious people, will say to me, the greatest tragedy was that the Baron Lichtenstein left America and went in Aliyah. Because the whole swing, they feel the swing to the right in YU, which causes a counter-reaction, which gives birth to Chovevei Torah. They felt if Rabbi Aaron would be there, there wouldn't have been that swing to the right. You follow? It's interesting. There's some truth to it. The most fascinating personality on the scene is the Rav, because the Rav, his chesed, Rav Chaim Moysa, at the Aguda Convention in 1940, 41, I believe it was 40, Chaim Moysa died in 40, and I believe the convention was later that fall after Rav Chaim Moysa died. His chesed for Rav Chaim Moysa, more than one great Aguda said to me, it was the most extreme Aguda statement ever made in America. Are you familiar with that chesed? Again, I can't go into it now. Take me an hour and a half. But it's a magnificent chesed on Das Teira and the Tzitz and the Choshen Mishpat. And leave it to the Rav that just as you ask Shailas, the Tzitz represents Halacha, represents Tumah V'Tara, represents Taret Mishpacha, represents Shabbat. Just as you ask Shailas, Kadosh LaHashem, the Tzitz, you ask a Rav. Choshen Mishpat represents Klal Yisrael, the Yud Beit Shvatim. Any question of an Am Yisrael nature, when even if it had nothing to do with Halacha, but political, national, monetarily, who you ask? The Gedolei Yisrael, the Reb Chaim Moysa, Das Teira. He was the individual of magnificent chesed. Everyone turned to Reb Chaim Moysa, not just in learning, not just in shailas, but all the Vaj Yeshiva, all the money, the Central Relief raised, we'll talk about it. Everything went through Reb Chaim Moysa's hands. So what a chesed that is, Das Teira par excellence. No one gave, so extreme, leaving no room for doubt. Choshen Mishpat sits, and you see the Rav, within 3-4 years, is with an entirely different gestalt, and you have to give him credit, he totally shifted gears. Very hard for the Aguda people to understand how a person can change his mind. But the reality of life, and that's the Chamesh Drashot with the Rav, it all fits together. The Chamesh Drashot, Yosef Yechov, where the Rav explains, when it comes to Halacha, we have to answer. The Tzitz, we have to answer. We have to give the Psak. We have to give the answer. You cannot look up to heaven. Lo bashamayim hi, lo me'vahayam. What did they say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Beat it out of here. We're giving the psak. Reb Lezer goes into Cherem because he refused. The Bat Kol said like Reb Lezer. And nevertheless, but when it comes to Choshen Mishpat, you can have all the machlokes in the world. We do not paskin. God lets you know who is right. And you always have to reevaluate in accordance with your concepts and these concepts and which worked out, what is the reality today? And there the Rav gave that magnificent talk, how the Machlokes Yosef Yechov, how to adjust to Egyptian civilization. So you see, Yosef was right, even though he was in the minority. And the Rav referred to Mizrahi as the Yosef HaTzadik of today. So, and he explains why he became a Mizrahiite. Okay. But you have to understand, in 1902 is axiomatic. There was no anti-Zionism in America. Yes, the Reform Jews were anti-Zionist. That's true. the Reformed Jews, America is our Palestine, New York or Cincinnati or Columbus, Ohio is our Jerusalem. We don't need Kabbalat, we don't need a Beis Hamikdash, but Torah Jews, they were total and totally involved with the nascent Zionist movement. And we'll see what happens after World War I, but this is 1902. Now, they send out the letter, and they tell everyone that we're going to hold this meeting, and we're inviting, and here we ended off the last class, and at this point it's going to haunt us, and the truth of the matter is that it greatly affects the reality of the Torah world in the United States today. And that is the question, who is a Rav? And right away in the original letter where they call for organization, they make it clear it's only going to be a European-trained rabbi who has smicha from the Litvische, Europäische, Hasidische, Gedole Yisrael, and they are the only ones who can be members. The second qualification is that it has to be a Rav who's a practicing rabbi. And you see, these two points haunt us in the century following this initial letter. It's going to come up time and time again. And Agudat HaRabbanim remain firm that the Johnny come latelys who are studying in America, who are studying at Yeshiva Shabbat Chochanan at the time, but even afterwards in Teira Vidas and Chaim Berlin, in RJJ, these are not Rabbanim, and they cannot be members of the Agudas HaRabbanim. Now, in the original letter, in the original proposal, they put down a number of very fascinating points that they throw out for thought. And I just want to mention some of these points.
Who
actually wrote it, we'll never know. I imagine Ramaz and Leventhal edited it, went back and forth between them, but no one really signed on it. It was signed by a number of these rabbanim, including the names I just mentioned. There was another Rabbi Silba, there was a Rabbi Friedman. These were all rabbanim who had succeeded in America and held large Orthodox congregations. The word Orthodox, I should say, East European congregations. Now, one of the proposals, and you'll understand this very well because this is the old question that's haunting us in the state of Israel today. Who will select the members of the Agudas HaRabbanim? And you see, here you come to the question of democracy or a self-perpetuating body. We're fighting that battle. You all know what's going on in Israel, the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, there's an expression in modern Hebrew, chaver mevi chaver. So if you're a self-perpetuating body, who do you self-perpetuate with? People who think exactly the way you do. This is not democratic. This is to protect the interest of the people who are organizing, founding this organization. In business, I can tell you, I'll give you a simple example from a family you know, the Schreiber family. Everyone, some of you, I was a classmate of Simi Schreiber, the chairman of the Board of Reeds today is Joel Schreiber. Schreiber family, what they have done, the Tarek Mishpacha, what the Schreibers put in, one of the Schreibers was the head of Tarek Mishpacha, they built mikvod all over the world, the tzedakah, the wonderful things these people did. But you see, they're running a business, and they had a tremendous business, they were manufacturing before China, this is before Vietnam, China, and all that goes on today. They're manufacturing undergarments, etc. That was the heart of their business. So the family, the founders of the business, the brothers who founded the business, wanted to be certain that the business will remain Shomer Shabbat. So they put in all types of clauses. I've seen the original charter of the business, that if it ever becomes Shomer Shabbat, if it ever becomes non-Shomer Shabbat, the business has to be sold, and the profits have to be distributed to charity. Something to that. Whether a court would uphold it, I have my doubts. In America, religion and the state affairs don't mix. I don't know. If there's a lawyer here, you can play with them, see whether there are any precedents in American law for charters like this to be held up 100 years later. I don't know. If the court would have to describe what is Shmirat Shabbat. The Reforms say they're also Shomer Shabbat. Aren't they claiming today they're Jews? You want to have kashrut? They'll say, we also observe Chveis. They'll give you some concept of kashrut that they... It's not a simple matter. For us, we know what Shabbat is, we know what kashrut, but you're going to go to a secular court? I don't know. But what's interesting is they took the precaution to guarantee. Now, the Schreiber family is blessed. It's generation after generation of Shomrei Torah and Mitzvah. Even in this very Kollel, there were Schreibers who studied L'Kavod U'L'Tiferet. There's a rabbi, they're all over the place. A wonderful, wonderful family. I don't know, by the way, I don't know for sure whether the rabbi in Ranana is a relation or a distant cousin. It has to be checked out. But generally speaking, the Schreibers and the YU, OU circles are all interrelated. So you see, what the Agudas Rabbanim stated immediately is that it has to be a self-perpetuating body. Not only people who they will choose and will accept. Rabbinical Council of America has a similar clause. It's not it doesn't involve Rabbanim from Europe or Smicha, but they, when in order to be a member of the RCA, you have to have a valid Smicha. They will not accept the private smicha. To the best of my knowledge, this continues until today. If you come with a private smicha, it's not acceptable. I would imagine if you have smicha from Moshe Feinstein, if you have smicha from Yaakov Kamenetsky, it could be that those smicha are acceptable. But to the best of my knowledge, the RCA also, you have to have a valid smicha, a smicha from the chief rabbinate in Israel, a smicha from Yeshiva University, a valid smicha. But this is one clause, self-perpetuating body. Now, very fascinating, because doctorates have been written about this. I can tell you one offhand, there's been more recently, something else came out, but Hal Gatzworth, anyone recognize the name? Dr. Gatzworth did a doctorate at Columbia University, Fraud, Corruption, and Holiness. And it deals with the machloket, what went on between the Rabbanim. And here too, you have to understand, rabbis, this was their livelihood. It's not today that a rav gets a salary from a congregation. Today, the opposite. I always tell young rabbanim, if you can work out a decent salary and make clear to your congregation that you take no money beyond your salary, it will enhance your rabbinate. And there are rabbanim that are in that position, that they will not, they go to a wedding, they go to a funeral, they give a heksha, they will not take money beyond what the congregation pays them. This is a public service. The bakery in the community has to be certified. By the way, in the state of Israel, I look forward to the day that the state will cover all kosher expenses. We pay taxes, and part that we should get back is that mashgichim should be paid by the state. This is what they're trying to do now, and essentially is what I'm saying, although it'll go through the Misrad HaDatot, not to be paid by the factory. Everyone pays taxes. This is something the government owes you. We're a Jewish state. We are responsible for hospitals, for safety, for bitachon, for an army, for a police force, and for kashrut. Here you deal with a situation, Rabbanim received no salary. Their salary was Chanukah geld, Purim geld, Mechirat chametz, a funeral, Gebena Heksha, this was their salary. So of course, this led to tremendous machloket. and the it was livelihood, parnassa. The elder rabbanim, then the young rabbis came on the scene. Ah, the machlekes that went on. What is kosher, what is not kosher, and there always the individual interest. It wasn't something that you could say is beyond individuality or subjectivity. So right away, they proposed right here that whenever there's a machlokes on matters of kashrut, communal questions, the Agudas HaRabbanim will have a committee that will mediate between the Rabbanim. And this was a beautiful proposal. These are all ideas that are being thrown out. Now, there's a second idea here, which also represents the times, the early 1900s. Most of the Rabbanim in America were products of the Lashon. Everyone learned in the Lashon. If not, people say you learned in the Lashon. Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook learned in the Lashon. I think B'sach HaKol learned 2 years in the Lashon. Everyone says Bialik learned in the Lashon. I believe Bialik learned about a year and a half in the Lashon. There were others that stayed in the Lashon many, many years, but everyone was a product of the Lashon. Pachot o yoter. There were some in America, Rabbanim, who were from the Hasidic world, but they were few and far between. The heart of the Rabbanim were Litvisha, Velashen, Smicha Bar Rebbe Scholchan and Spekta. This was who we were dealing with. Now, let's just say a few words about Velashen, which is hard for the art scroll generation to comprehend. We're living in a world today, you walk into a Litvisha yeshiva, everyone looks exactly the same. It's unbelievable. The black dress, the hat, the white shirt, everyone looks exactly the same. Pachot yoter, everyone thinks exactly the same. There's public pressure on you to think the same way, to act the same way. I've told you more than once, Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik couldn't handle this. It was a problem for him. Why? Go back to the Lashon. Show me two Gedolei Yisrael who eventuated from the Lashon who thought exactly the same. Everyone was different in the Lashon. It was part of the atmosphere. It was a different world. Zionism was beginning. Haskalah was beginning. You talk about Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. He was wide read. He knew what was going on. The newspapers, you all know with Dinitziv. What happened in the Lakewood? No, my uncle Dinitziv. The newspapers you read, I'm probably the last one in the world that went through all thousands of pages of the Makor Baruch. I love it, I love it. Not that you can believe everything he writes or take it. There's so much has been written showing that he's wrong. This couldn't have happened, you know, everyone has a comment to make. But the Makor Baruch, that's right, he was the Aruch HaShulchan's son. Rabbi Baruch HaLevi Epstein. He was a banker, but he was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, so he wrote the Torah Tamima. And he wrote other Sfarim, but in addition, he wrote a tremendous three-volume memoir, the Makor Baruch. So part of the Makor Baruch is about his uncle, Dinitziv. The uncle, Dinitziv. Dinitziv was his uncle. Dinitziv was married to the Aruch HaShulchan's, let me get this straight, the Aruch HaShulchan's daughter, actually. It was he was related, interrelated, twice. I believe the Aruch HaShulchan was married to the Nitziv's sister, and then the daughter, his second marriage, much, much younger. This is where Reb Chaim Berlin and Reb Meir Berlin are 48 years apart. Reb Chaim is from the first wife, and Reb Meir is from the second wife. And she only married him al tanai, he would live with her, and they should be able to conceive a child. I believe she was a divorcee when she married him, and he was an alman. And the Reb Meir Berlin writes how my mother took care of the Nitziv like a unbelievably better than his first wife. Because you have to understand, the first wife was the daughter of Reb Yitzchok Volozhin, Reb Yitzchok Volozhin. So she looked upon Reb Naftali Tzvi, a young kid with some promise, but it's not my father. The second wife already married the Gadol Hadar, and the Netziv had become the Gadol Hadar. But the Netziv, it was a different world. The openness, the thinking, the different Talmidim. The Netziv had battles with students. He once smacked a student he suspected of shaving, the whole question of shaving with the razor. And he had to apologize. The yeshiva was in an uproar. But you see, it was in turmoil. The Netziv, the Rav is the great-grandson of the Netziv. The Rav referred to the Netziv. Anyone know Reb Heshuleib? Whenever the Rav said Reb Heshuleib, he meant Reb Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. It took me a while to understand the Rav Tzeichen Don Reb Heshuleib, my Nelta Zayda, my great-grandfather. Who are you talking about? The Netziv. The Netziv's son-in-law was Reb Raphael Shapiro. Reb Raphael Shapiro's son-in-law was Chaim Soloveitchik. Chaim Soloveitchik's son was Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. Reb Moshe's son was Mori Rebbe, Reb Yosef Dov Halevi. So Volozhin had so many different opinions. And you see, all the heads, the founder of Mizrahi, Rav Reines, where did he come from? Volozhin. The founders of Agudat Yisrael, essentially. Where did they come from? Reb Chaim Moshe Grzhensky, Volozhin, everyone had to join. Reb Chaim Moshe joined Agudat Yisrael. Every Litvish Rosh Yeshiva more or less had to follow. And this was Volozhin. So here they speak about there'll be machloikis on public statements. They propose it will be put to a vote and you need 2/3 to carry an idea that will represent the Agudas HaRabbanim. You see, they're dealing with very, very, very basic problems here. Why do you need 2/3? Why isn't a majority enough? Look, this just happened in Yerushalayim. There's a kollel that's a fallout from my classes. Many, many years ago, I played a role in bringing the Wall, the Elder Walls. I taught their children, Max Wall. You all know, I'm sure you know Max Wall. Unbelievable personality and a bulldog. He gets things done. So he, first 2 years in Israel, came to my shiur room. Then he said to me, I need someone to teach me Gemara basics. I said, why don't you organize a kollel for retirees? And that's the kollel. So they're now looking, they were looking for a rebbe. I don't know what happened. Rabbi Herschel was there, not me more. He left, and they're looking for a rebbe. So there was a vote. There were three candidates. One they saw as not nishpasik, lo matim. How would you say that in English? I'm forgetting my English already, but that's a good sign. When you're more at home in Hebrew, which shows you've lived here a number of years. Nishpasik, lo matim. Not was not really fitting for the kollel. So there were two candidates left. So they tell me there was a vote like something 17 to 16. So they decided to hear Shurim again and vote again because you can't elect someone 17 to 16. Sure, it's a democracy, but you're leaving people so frustrated, you know, well, he was good. So 2/3 is what they said. We'll take a public stand that 2/3. Now, then something else involved. Rabbanim projects, see, they were very, the thinking here was very modern and very forward thinking. These Rabbanim, you take Ramaz, you take Rav Leventhal, they knew the American scene. They were totally acclimated to the American scene. Ramaz never really spoke English fluently. Rav Leventhal, I don't know if he spoke in English in public, but he was able to totally comprehend English and use it as a second language. But they knew the American scene. So they had another idea. If a Rav comes up with a project that's worthwhile and doesn't have the money to push it in his community, we should organize a charity fund that we will control and we will dispense it in accordance with the needs of the local Rabbanim. So you see, the ideas are beautiful. And they call a meeting for July 1902. They're going to meet in New York. And they say if we can have, I believe the figure was 25 Rabbanim who are interested, who will sign up, who will be willing to pay dues, we will form this organization. And now you see Hashgacha Pratit. The week they picked for the formal meeting that would organize the Agudas HaRabbanim, lo aleinu, it's exactly the week RJJ dies, the tremendous funeral, the riots with Ho and company. Instead of 25 Rabbanim coming, New York is mobbed, 60, 70, Litvische, Europäische, Hasidische Rabbanim are all there for the funeral. And like they viewed it as Min HaShemayim, the sun sets and the sun rises. Okay? The Gemara talks about this, that I don't have to tell you if you're familiar with the Igeret Reb Shriragon or the Hakdama Tarambam LeMishnah Torah, where he traces out the Torah Shebaal Peh, the old Gedolei Yisrael, you see the miracle. You saw here what happened in our time. Who would ever believe Europe, 6 million, so many Rabbanim, what is left? And take a look how Gedolei Yisrael raised the banner of Torah where we're at today, and look back to 1945. It's overwhelming. So you see, all right, a non-believer will say chance. The only problem is I'll tell a non-believer, chance can happen once, twice. But chance, Min HaShemayim. It was now the death of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef also plays a big role in the founding of the Agudas HaRabbanim. And here it's a simple reason. Let me put it on a very personal level. We take for granted what we have. So you all know, you'd look at a family situation, you have parents, grandparents. Sometimes you don't appreciate who came before you, what they did for you until they're gone. And that's the nature of the beast. Everyone is caught up in life. And I can tell you, I've told this before, but I don't know if I've told it in class. I'll tell you a meritic vort, and it's overwhelming. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein did not grow up on a tree. You all know his father, Dr. Yechiel. His mother was a Gaonet. His mother, I had the privilege of knowing her. So the family told me the following story. The grandchildren asked the mother, is there any pasuk in the Torah that you have difficulty understanding? And without batting an eyelash, his mother answered, yes, Cain. She spoke only Hebrew to Aaron, was raised in Hebrew, and only Hebrew to the grandchildren. And she said, yes, what pasuk? Al Cain Yazovishet Avivi Yomovet Avakti Ishto. Just think what she was saying. And it's true, but this is the nature of life. And you see it all the time. I can't get my whole family together no matter what. It's impossible. Everyone is caught up here, there, everywhere. I had invitations from great-grandchildren, great-grandchildren in the different parts of the country. It was impossible to do. So I said, I'm going for Haifa because that was my first commitment. You understand? But Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, everyone took him for granted. A great gadol came to America. Oh, what went on in America, the machloket, the disregard. You all remember my classes on Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, what's it, 3, 4, 5 years ago already. It's a number of years. But when he died, suddenly they realized how we sinned against this man, how we sinned against the rabbinate, how the rabbanim themselves fought with each other. We had a giant of Torah, Talmud Mufak of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, the Magid Meisharim of Vilna, and look what became of him in America. To add to the tragedy, was the funeral, what everyone speaks about until today, that how they're going to take the body by ferry to Brooklyn for the burial at the other end of Brooklyn. And as they pass Ho and Company, the Italians and the Irish rained down screws, nails. There was a manufacturing plant throwing down at the Jews, and the Jews run into the building to fight. There were hundreds of tens of thousands of Jews at that funeral. It was the biggest funeral, may have been the biggest funeral ever held in America, when Rabbi Aaron Cutler was buried. So there was a whole machlokes whether there was many as people there at the funeral on the Lower East Side as there were from Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, because there were still people alive. At Rabbi Aaron Cutler's funeral in 1962, there were still people alive who remembered as little kids the funeral of RJJ. But they took what was being thrown at them, and then the police, again, let me go one step further. Who did the police arrest? The Jews. And you have no idea what went on. And then there was a tremendous outcry. And in a democracy where it's not self-perpetuating, what we just spoke about, in a democracy, the politicians worry about the people that have a vote. You see the power Satma has today, that they haven't outlawed Mitzitza B'Pei. I mean, it's beyond words. Reb Chaim Brisker was against Mitzitza B'Pei. Reb Shem Shofal Hirsch was against Mitzitza B'Pei. The Rav was against Mitzitza. You go right down the line. Kids should suffer. You do it with the tube. It's no problem. No problem. If you know the sugya in Shabbat, what is Mitzitza B'Pei? Why Mitzitza B'Pei? It's just the opposite today. It was to cure the kid, to help. Today, adarabba v'adarabba, is there any chance of an infection? Do it in a way that there's no chance. But you see the power of Satma that the politicians couldn't outlaw it. No matter, kids died. Kids were, I've seen, God have mercy, I've seen pictures. You know the story with I'm not telling stories, Rabbi Yoel Schoenfeld. You know what I'm talking about? So Rabbi Yoel had a Brit, the Rav was there. And Rabbi Yoel went over to the Rav. He comes from Hasidish background. Hasidish family was there. And it could be his wife as well and her family. And he said to the Rav, Rabbi, I hope you'll forgive me, but the family's makpit at Mitzitza B'Peh. So the Rav said, I wasn't there. I was here in Israel. But I heard this from people who heard the conversation. The Rav said, you're lucky I'm more tolerant than my Zayda. Rav Chaim would have walked out, he said. But okay, I'll look the other way and do what you have to do. But they investigated the police, the Jews, and as a result, the police commissioner had to resign, and they say there never was formal anti-Semitism in the New York Police Department again, ever since the riots at Rabbi Yaakov Yosef's funeral. But here, the Rabbanim were sitting, were meeting, and the next day, and it was like Minas Shemayim, we have to have unity, 60, 70 Rabbanim, we never dreamt you would have so many, we have to organize. Okay, now, who did they elect as president? And here I'm going to... it's the high point of today's share. I'm going to show you something. It's like sometimes if you take a picture, you capture an era. I'm taking a halachic picture, capturing an era. They elect Rabbi Yaakov Gershon Lesser from Cincinnati as the president. Who is Rabbi Yaakov Gershon Lesser? So I wanted to get some information on him. I looked around the websites. Here's his tombstone. His wife, Lesser. Years, 1835-1925. He was a Litvisher Rav. He already precedes Volozhin. This was pre-Volozhin, you can imagine. Came to Chicago in 1880, moves to Cincinnati in the 1890s, and they write, greatest achievement, elected the first president of the Union of Orthodox Congregations. If you want the exact years, he came to Chicago 1882, moved to Cincinnati 1898, and he was a Talmud of Mir Yeshiva, which before the Lushan was organized slightly before the Lushan, or I would say 25 years before the Lushan, Talmud of Mir, the old original Mir, Rabbi Tikhon, Tikhatinkasi, it's a different world. Yeah, yeah.
Was it a contested election, or this was a...
No. He was the Elder Rabbi. It was unanimous. Now, this Rabbi Lesser, anyone from Cincinnati, in my days when I was growing up, people spoke of him. He was held in awe. And he was in America so many decades. He lived to a good old age. I wonder, I've never yet come across a Lesser in any of my classes. I wonder whether anyone survives. And from his family, I also have relatives Lesser. I have relatives, was a pharmacist, was my father's cousin, Lesser. I have relatives Lesser, but not related. He was in America already, imagine 1880s. All right, it has to be checked. Maybe they are related. You're related to them, right? The Lessers relate to you. Now, if you open up the Netziv, Shelet Tshuvit Meshiv Dava, Chelek Aleph, it's the 16th, Siman Tet Zayin. This tshuva captures America. The Netziv couldn't understand the question. You see, the Elichkeit in Europe, and what Rabbi Lesser has in Cincinnati. And I'll paraphrase, I'll tell you the story. And this is Rabbi Lesser, mentioned in the response to literature, the Chivas to Cincinnati. And here a guy comes to America, and America, the golden Medina, and he makes it good. It's a big shot, succeeded, made money. All right, he made money, and he wants to make a donation to the shul. So he's, you can imagine, a little shul, an East European shul, new building, need an Aron Kodesh. He is dedicating the Aron Kodesh. So far, so good. But now comes the American mentality. He's dedicating the Aron Kodesh. Rabbi Mrs. Revel told me, it's a good vart, she said, you don't know what, at the time I never knew it was my cousin. Today I should say, Mrs. Revel, married to my cousin, told me that my husband suffered when he had to raise funds. And that was ultimately becomes the main preoccupation of the president's Rosh Yeshiva of YU, Rabbi Revel, Rabbi Belkin, Rabbi Lamb, Richard Joe, now our student, Rabbi Ari Berman, have to call him Rabbi Doctor. You have to give cover to your student. You all know the Medrash on Yosef Yaakov at the end. So money. And he said, why did he suffer? Because he could get money from Balabatim, but it was always COD. Zev, you remember COD? Believe me, the youngsters cash on delivery. Charlie, do you remember COD? When you got a package in the mail, you had to pay the post office, and they passed on the money and kept a small percentage. Like today, everything is ordered. You pay. What's your Visa number? You give your Visa number out a million times over. I want to know. I want to tell you. I once was compromised. I gave my Visa number out, and lo and behold, people are. I see my Visa being billed in places, cities that I never. Garden City, Long Island, never was there in my life. All I knew was Reader's Digest in the 1930s, 1940s was published in Garden City. So, COD, covered on delivery. Yeah, the guy will give you money, but you gotta pay with covered. No, get the guy covered. So he put down the conditions to Rabbi Lesser. He wants on a Sunday morning. What does it mean, Sunday morning? No one works Sunday morning. People are free. He wants a party in the shul, and they should dedicate the Aron Kodesh by taking out a Torah and giving him an aliyah bifnei Am V'Eda, that Mr. Big, who built the Aron Kodesh, should be able to make the brachot in front of all the men, women, and children, and everyone should know how wonderful he is. Wow, what a question. That might have been an easy solution. I thought of that right away. I thought of that years ago when I saw the tshuva, but somehow it never came up. Evidently, he picked a Sunday when he was free, when his family could be there, and l'chavad l'tiferet, he was dedicating the Aron HaKodesh. The poor Netziv couldn't understand the question, how could a man want to do anything against the halacha? Rabbi Lesser writes to him that perhaps it's lotosif, how can you make a leining when a leining is not required? So, and you read the tshuva, the Netziv writes back that in relation to lotosif, that is not the main problem. The main problem is brachot levatala. The whole concept of leining at a time when Chazal did not decree the leining, brachot levatala. Now we have a tremendous problem. We just celebrated Simchas Torah. Now I want to ask you a question. Forget it. Leining at night, all right? In the shul I daven, they don't lein at night. At the kotel, I remember at my minyan, all the years I went to the kotel, we didn't leein. But many shuls lay in at night. How can you lay in at night? Brachot levatala. I'm told that in Maimonides in Boston, they lay in that night. Yitzchak, am I right? Do you remember? You don't remember. I'm told they lay in that night. Brachot levatala.
What
are the rules? That's what I'm talking about, Maimonides. I try to find out what the Vilna Gaon, and I get two different opinions. You look at the Maisa Rav and you look at the others, you get two different opinions. Laying, didn't lay. But forget about laying at night. See, Yontif morning, my family began. I go to what used to be a private minyan. I have to admit, I'm not a big chassid. I'm a litvak. I can't help. I'm not telling you not to be a chassid. Don't misunderstand me. But to me, Yontif, I did two blat and yevamot on Simchas Torah. I'm dancing for joy. You understand that? I understood yevamot, that I can understand the diagrams of it. How many of you have learned yevamot? You know, ani, the three most difficult mesechet. Ani, a ruven, nida, yevamot. And I hold Yevamot is the most difficult. The other Masechta, at least, you know, a little mathematics, a little autonomy, you can work it out. But Yevamot, you have to have a mind that sees in 3D, and the brothers and the sisters and the couples and the marriage and the children and the zikah. So I'm a litvak. So all the years I've been davening 6 o'clock in Yol Rivka. All right. Now my children, a number of years ago, began a 6 o'clock minyan in the shul they run. So, of course, their saba has to daven with it. So we had a 6 o'clock minyan. We had to split into 3 kriyot haTorah. We had to be out of there by 8:30. The second minyan comes in, which is already all day. So we finished 8:20, 8:15, Baruch Hashem, 3 split. Wait a minute. Kriyot haTorah? I only know Shabbos 7. Yom Kippur 6, Yom Tov 5, Chol HaMoed 4, Monday and Thursday 3. Who ever heard of every Jew, every Tom, Dick and Harry, every Tzaddik in Russia has to have an Aliyah? Did you ever hear of such a thing?
When did this start?
It's not for now. When did it start? There's a whole book written by Ya'ari on Simchas Torah. You'll have all the sources. We already see traces of it in the Gaonic period. It starts, and you say 13, 14. Say them, I'll accept that.
Rabbi Wein says it.
Sorry. Rabbi Wein, okay. It's open to great lamdanit. When did it start? How did it start? And you see, it conquered the world. You understand, Morty?
What about
you're
supposed to bring down halacha from the Gemara?
You're supposed to bring out Sarah Tasser and Shmini Atzeres. You mean the Gemara? Say that. Yeah, absolutely. Gemara and Megillah, that we changed the readings, changed Taftorahs. All right. That I can understand, that it's not something, it's not a din d'oraita, it's a minhag, I would say. I wouldn't even put it into a din d'rabbanan, it's a minhag, it's what they read, all right, we can shift gears. But who ever heard of a 100 aliyot in one shoe? All right, I can go on and on. What do you do? Tell me, after you hear the first 5 aliyot, do I have your name on the list? Aaron White. Okay, I'm glad. I'm happy to see you, Aaron. First of all, where is everyone else? Have the fellas come back? Is there anyone here?
I don't know.
You don't know. Aaron White. Okay. Welcome. Let me concentrate on learning the name so I don't call you black and I call you white. But, I mean, you have no idea what halachic problem this is. It's unbelievable. And I'll ask you a different question. Aaron White heard it's Yontif, so you have 5 aliyot, right? He heard the first 5, and now they're repeating and repeating and repeating. His name is Aaron, my name is Aaron, we're both Litvisha. So before you know it, Aaron White pulls out a Gemara, and he's sitting and learning and learning and learning, and you say, well, why aren't you listening to the Torah? He says, no, I heard already. No, does he have a right to say that? Here you have to have, maybe yes, maybe no. What is Kriyat HaTorah? Is Kriyat HaTorah learning Torah? Or is it a reproduction, a reliving of Maimed HaSinai? Hear the Rav's voice and my voice now? Okay, the Rav gave Yotzai Shurim on this. If it's learning Torah, Aaron White is acting correctly. You follow? I've heard the first 5 laning. I was Yotze. I learned. I want to learn Shas and Paiskim now till they finish laning. And an hour from now, let me do something productive. If it's Shechzur, reliving, you follow me, Vic? Maimir Hasinai, Murray? You got to stand and listen to every word. You cannot take the attitude, I heard. So you heard, but right in front of you is Maimed HaSinai. You have no idea what we're talking about. What goes on? Who heard of this? And yet, let me see one person here have the chutzpah to say, I'm opposed to Simchas Torah. You see, something happened here. The Jewish people have strength, have power. We created Simchas Torah. This didn't come from on high. Hoshana Rabbah. There's a Jew who should live and be well. He's not in the best of health today. Eliezeri Frankel. When I wished him a guten kvittel once in the Shtiblach, in Katamon, a yekka. You know the Frankel, you know what I'm talking about. The real yekka. This is not a yekka who's been refined by Yeshiva University, by Talmudical Academy and Harvard University. He's correct. My son-in-law once wrote a letter to him and wrote Harav. He sent it back and he had to write Hechaver. So I wished him a guten kvittel. He got hysterical. A fokatuv devakaze. Mam korot. Mazel shana rabba. Hysterical. Show me, he's right. Show me one makar in the Gemara. Hoshana Rabba. Hoshana Rabba. One makar. We don't have it. It's Kabbalistic. Got developed. And whoever heard, Yitzchak, you davened Hoshana Rabba? What did you say, Pirkei Dezimra? No? You added like Shabbos, like Yontif? Logically speaking, you're a boor. You're an Amoritz. The only time we say the long Psukei Dezimra is when there's no Malacha, when there's an Isha Malacha, so it requires more Psukei Dezimra, there's no Tircha de Tzibura, there's more Kedushat Hayom, Hoshana Rabba, there's no Isha Malacha, it's Chalamayid. No? And you're saying long Psukei Dezimra? Look what the Jews, look at the power of the Jews. One more second, Morty, and I'll tell you more. Can anyone tell me what happened Sunday, Chol HaMoed? The biggest crowd ever to be at the Kotel at one time. 100,000 Jews. There were more. The day that they opened the Kotel, first day Shavuos, 1967, A quarter of a million Jews were at the Kotel. People slept on the streets. People slept in the parks in Jerusalem, came from all over the country, slept on the floor. But then you walked to the Kotel, you had to come in. There were paratroopers all over. It was the first time they let Jews into the old city. They had to be sure there wouldn't be a security problem. So you went to the Shaar Yafo, you walked all the way around and came out at Shaar Shechem, I believe. That's the way the path went. So in the course of the day, a quarter of a million people walked. But here at one moment, 100,000 people, Birchat Kohanim, people come in from England, from Belgium, from all over the world, and you see they're broadcasting. The people are there with their life, their family, with your magic little iPads, little gizmos. You see the picture? Wow. Tell me, give me a source for Birchat Kohanim at the Kotel, Chol HaMoed. Give me a source. One Jew in the 1970s came across a rokeach that it's a schut, Birchat Kohanim, and he came up, we'll do it at the Kotel. And the first time I was there, a few thousand were there. Take a look what became with Birchat Kohanim. So you see there's a power that the Jewish people have. Yes, Morty.
Several years ago, the Rebbe spent all time on Minhag Oseh Halacha.
I spent on what? On Minhag?
Minhag Oseh Halacha.
Yeah, no, Minhag Koveya Halacha. Minhag Koveya Halacha. Minhag Mavatil Halacha. That's also in, I don't know, I spent much time. But I'm showing you that this is not a simple issue. Now, this tshuva became very famous in World War II. Do you remember how, why? Very simple.
The army chaplains.
Yeah, the army chaplains. In World War II, the Jewish Welfare Board, I don't know how it runs today, I would imagine it's the same principle. The Jewish Welfare Board, which was responsible for the chaplains and providing for them and providing their needs in service, they had a rule that when they got a halachic question, they would try to reach an answer that all so-called branches could accept. So the question came up, the soldiers in those days, they fought by day, not by night. Today it's a different world. Today in warfare you're fighting 24/7. Of course they have night sight and many developments. My son-in-law was actually involved in Merkavat. Let me just think it out. Merkavat 2 and Merkavat 3, my son-in-law, who's a Mahon Lev graduate, won awards for his work in putting night sight, developing the night sight for the tanks. He once came home, I remember, decades ago, and he took me out in the terrace 12 midnight, and he showed me something from the army. He says, Abba, look into it. I look in, broad daylight, midnight. Broad daylight. So this is all part of the tanks. The planes today, it's a different world. But World War II, the only time that the soldiers could come together to daven on Shabbos was Friday night, not the daytime when they were in battle or on war alert. So the question came up, can they lay in the Torah at night? And the whole question of Simchas Torah was discussed, and this tshuva was actually quoted. But they reached the conclusion, you can lay in the Torah at night, but without brachat, which essentially solved the problem. To lay in the Torah, you can lay in any time. How did people learn, Aaron, if not from opening a Torah? You understand the Rambam Paskins La'alacha, that women can study Torah Shebichtav. Now what does that tell you? If women can study Torah Shebichtav, it solves all problems with women when they're nida. Can they come into the synagogue? Can they touch a Torah? Can they hold the Torah? You see that they studied from a Torah. What did they study from at that time? That all you had was a Torah Shebichtav in the full sense of the word. So women can study, you can lay in, you can do what you wish, but not to make brachot. They would be brachot levatala.
Rabbi Leo Young,
right,
was the Orthodox representative of
on that committee. Right, correct, correct. And this is what they agreed upon. So this tshuva, the poor netziv, goes through the halachot, And he shows, how do you establish this is not, again, he doesn't deal with Simchas Torah, but Simchas Torah, Klal Yisrael wins out. Who can come and abolish what we have done to justify it is a different question. But here, one individual in Cincinnati, and he's holding his head high, and he's demanding that I want the laning. So the end of the tshuva, the Netziv says, Ubiyamet lo yadati mara ha'ish mahaya ha'ish ha'mitchare la'asot maisa kezeh shalom adam ha'korom. You see, he doesn't understand America, doesn't understand COVID, the limits. But you see, what did it say, writes? The Yemeno Katil Kanya, Mehanachon Sheyevaeh, Eze Makar. He says, and if he's not an Amaretz, it's a rabbinic expression, if he doesn't pick willows, and he's not an Amaretz, let him give us the Makar. The Yemeno Makar, Ela Shtut Vegaset Ruach Litchaleich Begedolot Hamafliot Lev Hamon. We cannot agree with him. You see, if he's just a Baal Kaif and he wants to covet from the people, he wants to show off, then we have to tell him it is absolutely impossible. And here's the description. It's a photograph. That's exactly America. Exactly the Balabas. Exactly the man who made it big. Exactly the oligarch. In modern Russian, and what's going on, and he watched the poor Rabbi Lesser objected, and of course when he objected, the Balabatim said to him, "This is the rabbinate." Never said to him, "Rabbi, you crazy? We have a chance to have the Aron Kodesh dedicated. What does it bother you so? Let him lay in, let him read, let him make the bracha, let us give him up covered." And the Netziv says to him, "Tzadak malat kvodo shemicha b'zeh, v'lo yachush l'manda mitza'erle." And don't be concerned with those who trouble you. Chepato el tchekel tashuv, v'kavod le'ish, and it's kavod for those who fight an honest battle in honor of the Lord, in honor of Torah. V'yizkenu sheyakol b'necha limudei Hashem v'rav shalom b'nayach. And you see, the Netziv is never trying to help him. So you see from this tshuva, it's a photograph of what America is about, of what the rabbinate is about, what life was like at that time, and COD, covered on delivery. To a certain degree, nothing has changed. Give me one more second, and I just want to comment, and this is the way the Netziv signs off. Divrei ha'amus ba'avodah. These are the words of someone that is overwhelmed by all the responsibility he has. Time and again, you'll see the Netziv sign off that way. Divrei ha'amus ba'avodah. Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. So very fascinating. Who is the first president? That tshuva. And you see already, the Rabbanim have nishke lekt honey. They didn't lick honey. It's a Yiddish expression in their shtelas. This was the reality. Yes, Morty.
Would he have answered differently if the question had been about never soldiers out in the field who were chalashim to daven to hear the Sefer Torah?
I think the answer not to make a bracha is a good answer. Yeah. That you can read the Torah Friday night.
You wouldn't have put them down like that.
Yeah, no. Here you're dealing with, he understood himself. The guy wants cover, the guy wants to show what I accomplished, what I did, the money I made, Mr. Big. You know how many shuls, how many young Israels were organized because someone was offended that he didn't get the proper aliyah, didn't get the proper cover, didn't get the proper haftorah. He has, don't ask, time and again. Fights are endless when it comes to human beings. And this is what the Muslim movement tried to correct. But you know, my vat, Hasidish captured millions, and the Musaf, it captured a few hundred. I'm overstating the case. Because this is the human being. I have one advantage. I have to be honest. I'm at the age where I have to review my life. I have to be honest. I got killed in my first rabbinate. 61, 62. I look back. I was 23 years of age. I got caught up in machlokes and what went on, the old God, the new God. I write about it in Washington, like Charlie Liebman became famous off that article where he uses my shul as the example. I'm the case study there, where it says young rabbi, cross out young rabbi, write Aaron Rothkopf. So if he makes the point, if someone walked in with a pen on Shabbos, no one would say a word to him. But if someone walked in with sits it out, they'd be all upset. This looks too fanatic for our synagogue. And I got caught up with that. And I couldn't handle it. I didn't know how to handle it. I was reelected 9-7. And Charlie Liebman analyzes the 9 people who voted for me and the 7 who voted. It's a fabulous article. And he says the 7 people were basically Shomer Shabbos, modern, so-called modern Orthodox of that ilk. And they felt they had a word that they know as much as the rabbi. They have a right to their opinion, and the rabbi is face doesn't fit in, too frum, too this, too that. The 9 who voted for me were Mechalel Shabbos, Ochei Levelet and Trefet. But they didn't question. If the rabbi says this wine is kosher, this wine, you know, the whole story with the Tref wine that I got caught up with, which again, you don't have a solution. What was I to do? Until today, I can't say. But I had one advantage out of that. Ultimately, I lost my whole concept of self-interest, self-chveis, aggrandizement. It affects me until this very moment. I have absolutely no desire, no need for cover. Let me just teach, let me just learn, let the Kaddish Baruch Hu be pleased with me. But most people are not like that. And you have to be careful, and in the rabbi, you have to know to be able to make a person feel good, to make a person do something good, give me acknowledgement. And I've seen that throughout life, and I can understand that wealthy man. But to be that arrogant that he's hitting the rabbi and he's determining, this is America, exactly America, staring you right in the eyes. But that was Rabbi Lisa. Now, let me go further. We now touch another problem, which again comes up time and time again. They now organize, and they're putting down a charter. And they've worked on this, and they've worked it out. And one of the main questions, what language do the rabbis speak? What language do you teach? What language? Talmud Torah? There were no yeshiva yet, basically. But even if there were yeshiva, Rabbi Shochanan and Eitz Chaim, and very soon there'll be RJJ, which is named in memory of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, even if there'll be schools, what's the language of instruction? And here they were adamant that Yiddish has to be the main language. Jargon, they called it. And the only exception they made, if you see the children don't understand Yiddish that well, then perhaps it's worthwhile also translating into the language they do understand perfectly, Bisfat Anglit. And you see, this question haunts us. It comes up again and again with the Agudas Rabbanim, comes up with the schools, comes up. And here, the famous story that I heard from the people involved. I'm not giving you Edmi Piet, I'm giving you literally in their own words. Maimonides began, but it didn't begin in a vacuum. The Rav inherited in Boston a high school that met as a Talmud Torah. Now that was very unique. Generally speaking, Talmud Torah was till the kid became a bar mitzvah, And the minute the kid became a bar mitzvah mark, he walked out, and that was the end of his education. And you know the story. The kid goes to a Talmud Torah. The kid comes home. The tata says, "What are you learning?" "Oh, I'm learning how to say Kaddish." The father's hysterical. He goes to the Rebbe in the Talmud Torah. "What are you teaching my kid how to say Kaddish? I'm alive. I'm not dead." "There's, don't worry, by the time he learns how to say Kaddish, you'll be dead." But the Rav inherited, I think it was called Mishkan Yisrael, if my memory is correct. I write about it. So the Rav inherited, and he really was his main interest before Maimonides, was developing that kids should learn in high school, come 3 afternoons a week, learn Gemara. He really made an attempt to raise the level. Ultimately, you reach the conclusion there's only a limit to what a Talmud Torah can do. And you all know that today everything has been replaced by the day school and the high school, the yeshiva high schools. But this was a different era. So the Rav insisted that the studies be in English. Who taught Gemara? And here's the interrelationship that I wish I would have a Talmud who would undertake to do a doctorate on Rav Shmuel Belkin. Rabbi Belkin, I just got more printed information on Rabbi Belkin. It's in my office. I have beautiful information that you can quote. That way you're not writing it, you're quoting it. And it's a reliable source. And it explains Rabbi Belkin's personality. Some of the problems that later come out, you're quoting. So it's very good, very good. But it's honest. So Rabbi Belkin now comes to America in 1928, comes to Canada actually, then comes to New York, comes into the yeshiva. The man cannot speak English. He's a Nilui, Shasim Paiskim, Yiddish, but not English. And within a few years, he's already studying at Brown University in Rhode Island. He's taking classes at Yale. His book, his doctorate, is later published by Harvard. I mean, it's an amazing thing. Within a few years, a greenhorn is Harav Doctor Professor. He needed money. So the Rav loved him. There was a kinship there. Above all, the Rebbetzin had great admiration. There was a kinship. Same nugget at Yiddish tradition. They spoke Yiddish. They were at home. They loved, and Dr. Belkin was an Eloi. He was an Eloi. And had a good sense of humor. And the Rav and the Rebbetzin loved him. So they gave him panasa. He taught for the Rav. It's a very fascinating story that I'm about to tell you. He taught for the Rav in the high school, the Gemara. So the Rav insisted he teach in English. The students, and here you all know the name Macy Gordon, who just passed away. Rabbi Macy Gordon had an older brother, Rabbi Jimmy Gordon. Rabbi Jimmy Gordon was in this class. Their father, I believe, was a sheikh in the Boston area. They were nephews of Rabbi Chil Michal Gordon, the Lamsha Rosh Yeshiva, the Petach Tikva Lamsha Yeshiva afterwards. And he had Rabbi Belkin teaching Gemara, but he wanted him to teach in English. The students, Dr. Belkin's English at this point in life, the rest of his life as well. I mean, if you ever heard, Dr. Belkin couldn't speak in any language. It was amazing that this man did so much, raised so much, sat with Einstein, sat with the greatest important people. He could barely speak. If you listen to tapes of him, even in Yiddish, it's not the Rav. The Rav was an orator par excellence. But in English, he certainly he couldn't speak clearly. So the students complained they wanted Rabbi Belkin to teach the Gemara in Yiddish. Yiddish, haben sie verstanden from the Stutt, they knew from the house, and they understood his Yiddish. His Yiddish was infinitely better than his English. So the Rav got wind of it. Evidently, Reb Shmuel asked his friend, the Rav, he called the Rav Beryl, he called him Shmulik, they were bosom buddies. Asked the Rav, "What should I teach you?" "That I will handle it." The Rav walks into class. This is the mid-30s, early, and the Rav already, you know, had a reputation. And he says, Anyone here complaining about Rabbi Belkin teaching in Yiddish, in English? No complaints? No one opened their mouth. This is hail, brimstone, and fire. No one opened. Rabbi Belkin, you will continue in English. You understand? The Rav, tell me, in Maimonides, were the classes in Yiddish or English in your time?
Only English.
Only English. And you already had the Shanghai crowd. You understand?
Right.
And I was, my life changed. I'm going to talk about it in depth, but not now, not yet. There's a reason why, you'll see, but not yet. My life changed. I was in, who did I have as Rebbeim? Garnished. Suddenly in 7th grade, I have Reb Gershon Yankel Lubitsch, fresh off the boat. I didn't know a word of Yiddish. He didn't know a word of English. 8th grade, I had Reb Chenich Fishman. No, I had to learn Yiddish. Then I went up in Lakewood, and I told you more than once, in Lakewood, Freddie Zucca, Zichrona Levracha, Freddie Zucca from Baltimore. I hope relatives of his are listening. He died young. He was a big, Lakewood, you have to know this guy, what was going on? And it's not Lakewood of today. Lakewood of today, I just saw a disgrace this morning. I saw on the website, Olamam Shel Charedim, Lakewood having a post-Sukkot celebration for bringing and singing Chabad songs, unless they're pulling my leg, unless Chaim Shulzin is wrong. That wasn't Lakewood. Go look and see. I couldn't believe my eyes, couldn't believe my ears. It's Chabad. We buy the Shalom. Everyone's Hasidic today. I'm going to wear a sign, the last Litvak who yet learned in Velazhen. And believe me, I'm entitled to that sign, whether you like it or not. So in Lakewood, Freddie Zucker convinced me that Torah is given in Yiddish, and the only way you can learn Torah is in Yiddish. And Moshe Rabbeinu spoke Yiddish with the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the worst part is that I believe him until today. You know that. What can I do? But you see, this problem comes up already. This is the early 1900s. Rabbi Aaron Cutler came to America. He banged on the table. Only in Yiddish. Didn't succeed. Only in Yiddish.
So today, what language now in Lakewood?
Nah, Lakewood today. What Lakewood? When Lakewood? It's an American institution. It's like cherry pie, apple pie. What are you talking about? I don't know. Is there any Shira? I mean, in Mir, you have in every language under the sun. Mir is different. Mir here in Yerushalayim. The public shir is now in Hebrew. That's an innovation, not in Yiddish anymore. But of course, you got to remember, it's not the old Rav Shach broke his teeth to speak Hebrew. You got to give Rav Shach. There's a lot of criticism of Rav Shach today because of what's going on in Lakewood and the politics. Anyway, with all the criticism, I want to give credit. He was the first one to welcome the Sfatim into his world, and he had to speak Hebrew. And you have endless. I taught in Michlala with Rabbi Yitzchak Peretz, the Rav of Ranana. He spoke. I used to speak to him in Yiddish. I said, "Vukunza saicha, let nazala, tishmaki Yiddish. How do you speak such a wonderful Yiddish?" He said, "I learned in Panovich how to break my teeth, and one after another." But he tried his best to speak Hebrew. But you can see Rav Shach, in the famous talk he gave about the kibbutzim, about the shvanim, the famous talk. So if you recorded that talk, I listened to it so many times, you'll see he breaks down, and when he gets very emotional, he can only speak Yiddish. In that public talk, and if you recall, Rav Ovadia was sitting next to the Belzer Rebbe, and when Rav Shach began to talk Yiddish, the Belzer Rebbe is leaning over and telling Rav Ovadia what he's saying in Hebrew. And you follow? Touched up, exactly. And so you see, this is a problem. But look, we have to be honest. Inevitably, it doesn't matter what language you speak. Shabbat has to remain Shabbat. Kashrut, Tarat Mishpacha. The main thing is to convey the message. What's the proof that I'm bright? With all due respect to Freddie Zucker and Lakewood and Rabbi Aaron Cutler, The Rav. I was there. I mean, I shiver, I shake because of the names involved today. And the Rav was sitting here. I was sitting here. You had the pictures in my office. It doesn't lie where I sat. And it's 1960, and there's Danny Greer. And Danny Greer said, I didn't know that he knew the Rav. His family knew the Rav from Moria. I didn't know that at the time. I thought it was chutzpah. Danny Greer comes over, a stranger wanders in, he says, Rabbi Soloveitchik, I have just graduated Princeton. Oh, the Rav hears Ivy League College. The Rav just graduated Princeton. You are withholding Torah from Jewish children. What fuck are you talking about? I don't understand Yiddish and I want to study with the Rebbe for 1 year. I'm taking off from graduate school. And the Rav, word by word, I'm telling you, I was sitting right here. My ears were, I still hear a little bit, but then I certainly heard that perfectly. And the Rav says, all right. Tomorrow the shiur will be in English, and I will give you a beginner at the end of the shiur. This was Tuesday. Wednesday, the Rav begins the shiur. Abba Braunschweigel, your Rebbe, my chaver, was fainting because he was an immigrant. He was a schmacker junger Mann, but his native language was Yiddish. He was a greenhorn. And his Robert Braunschweigel, his Zayda, when his Zayda walked into the room, the Gerer Rebbe, the Ra'im, Rabbi Avraham Mordechai, stood up for his grandfather. He was the Malamed Dardiki of the Gerer Rebbe, of the third Gerer Rebbe, the most famous Gerer Rebbe, Rabbi Avraham Mordechai. I mean, famous that the Gerer achieved in hundreds of thousands. He built Agudat Yisrael. And Abba was so upset. And we didn't know that the Rav with his English, with Reb Chaim in English, I tell you, was way above us. We were dying. At the end of the class, Danny Greer comes over to the Rav with chutzpah. Ready? I'm ready for the Bechina. And there's a, you understood? Yes. Gnug. It's enough for me. You understood? I'm too tired to give Bechinas now. I will continue in English. The Rav never went back to Yiddish in the Gemara Shir in the Yeshiva. All that remained in Yiddish was the Yotzeit Shir in memory of his father when he brought his father to life at Gedafret in Yiddish and the Tshuvah Drasha. That's all that remained in Yiddish. The Achaitala later is in English. The Boston is in English. The Shir is in English. But the main thing was to get the message across. Okay? But this problem, it's unbelievable. Right here, 1902, they are already talking about what Yiddish. Akein b'makom sh'asafa meduberet to rak English, as yitrugam lechem b'safa chachu. Then you can translate. But the basic language has to be Yiddish. Okay. I want to pause at this point. I have a lot to give out. But what do we see today? We're setting the stage. It's amazing that the problems we're going to touch upon are going to color the history of Torah for the next 100 years, basically. These are not problems that go away and not problems that can be easily solved. The language problem, machloiket after machloiket after machloiket. And when Rav Aaron Cutler came to America, the Yiddish concept intensified. Rav Aaron had a tremendous amount of influence. We'll talk about him, but not yet. Tremendous amount of influence. It's fascinating, Rav Aaron's life. And it's very sad that we don't have a proper biography of Rav Aaron Cutler. But as I've told you more than once, it's Yadskro can't do the biography because too much is known about his youth, his sister, his desire to go to Moscow University. They can't do it and hide the facts because too many people know. And if they do it and don't hide the facts, Yadskro will be put in Cherem 1,000 times over. It'll make Reb Nosson Kamenetsky's plight look light by comparison. The Hamevin Yavin. But it's a shame. It's a shame. Okay. Rabbi RJJ, the funeral, it's just beyond words. One day afterwards is the meeting of the foundation of the Agudas HaRabbanim. The riot, they're sitting there and we got to do something. It encourages. And instead of 25, 60 to 70 Rabbanim are in the room who, many of them came in, not for Agudas HaRabbanim, but came in for the funeral. But once they were there, they participated. Rav Gershon Lisa, in Hebrew it's Lisa, but in English it's Lessa. We'll go by the English. Rav Aram Gershon Lessa, very fascinating individual, and the old timers from Cincinnati in my time spoke of him with awe. Yet that was the influence he had. He probably was the first Litvish. Remember, we spoke about German-Hungarian Rabbanim, Cincinnati, Baltimore. We spoke years ago. But
he got along with Rabbi
Eliezer Silver. Rabbi Silver. By the time Rabbi Eliezer reaches Cincinnati, he's not alive. You can't put them in the same... he reaches Cincinnati 32. When did you say he died? 25, I believe, right? 1925. But that tshuva, if you ever need a picture of America, of the balabatim, of the rabbanim, of the wealth, of the COD, of the poor nitziv having to answer, hinanicha musbavoda, that tshuva captures it. But it opens a world of introspection and thought. What is really the halacha with reading the Torah when not demanded, when not instituted. And the truth of the matter is, no one in the world has been able to justify what we do on Simchas Torah. The only answer is that the will, the two gemaras that I always call, Fuk Hazim Mayama Davar, and Imlo Neviyim Heim B'nei Neviyim Heim. So it shows you that the Jewish people have the ability to innovate, but the innovations are such that they're filled with Yirat Shemayim and love and the Aliyot and the children and all that goes on and the Chatan Torah and the Chatan Bereshit. And I was Chatan Torah. I pleaded with my grandson, I don't give it to me. There are people here that will really make them feel good. I've been Baruch Hashem, a Chatan, many. But I had no choice. So I wound up being Chatan Torah. So Baruch Hashem. Well, yes, Yitzchak.
Now maybe someone from the virtual audience will get an understanding. It's possible to write a Jewish history utilizing Shilas and Shulas as a makor to illustrate a point.
So now let me tell you, when I was in graduate school with Agus, Professor Agus, right? You remember him, Avram Yitzchak Agus? So he was very, very strident. So he would make statements. We would take it with a grain of salt. He's the one who got in trouble with Rav Heschel Schechter. Rav Heschel got in trouble with him. Remember with the Rambam, with sex, what went on. And I'll never forget that Abba and I walked out of class and we said to each other, boy, he is an epicurus. How do you talk like that? 2 years later, a year later, he said the same thing in front of Rav Heschel Schechter. And he ripped Kriya, told him off in class, and he threw him out. He couldn't repress him. But that was that's why he's Rav Shechta, and that's why I'm only Ani Roscoff, okay? That's the reason. But it was a riot, but he couldn't graduate. You don't know what went on. He was lacking a course in Jewish history. He couldn't get his bachelor's. So finally, they made a deal with Bernard Rebbe Graduate School. He could take his father's course. And he got credit for that, or he took another course, but Professor Agus wouldn't take him back. So Agus once made the grandioso statement, we can write all of Torah history. We know the facts. So my hand shut up. Well, how do we know the facts? What are you going to do? There are no newspapers 1,000 years ago. What are you going to do? He says, Shelet and Tshuva. And boy, he was right, and you are right, Yitzchak. And exactly from, you can't write the whole history, but you get a good feeling of what went on. and there was just a doctorate done on from Jews who committed sins in public. I'm sure it's based upon responsa literature. Okay, now next week, next Sunday, life goes back to normal, and I deal with something that no one has ever dealt with halachically before or afterwards. Reb Menashe Klein, what's the halachic implications of a holdup? And you'll see the ramifications and how he ties it in with a Tosfot. Very, very fascinating. That's what makes Reb Menashe Klein so unique. A holdup with a gun. Give me your money or your life. What are the implications? Next Monday, Be'ezrat Hashem, we pick up exactly where we left off. Now, I feel very bad that there's no Chabadnik in the class. How can you teach a class without Chabad? If anyone didn't see Yisrael Hayom for Simchas Teira, let me pronounce it properly, an article on Chabad women, word by word what I've said in class, that Chabad has totally solved the feminist problem. Very moving. And her story, she was an officer in the Israeli army, not from, didn't know too much. And when she finishes the army, she goes on her trip around the world, winds up in Australia, and they invite her into a home there. And it's a Chabad house, like many homes in Australia. And that Shabbos, what she saw in that house, she said, I want to have a house like that. That changed her whole life. And she's an outreach, fabulous article. Baruch Shekivanti, that my theories turned out to be the truth. Anyone wants my Inotecha Chabad, very fine articles. This is on Rav Kook trying to explain his writings as part of a series. What they're doing is beautiful. This is the counter to reaction to what I gave out. If you recall, I gave out a few weeks ago a psak, how you can go up the Harabayan and what you have to do. Here is from the Mekas Harav crowd, evidently, coming out against going up the Har HaBayit with sources. Interesting. This is our friend Rav Yosef Mizrahi. Worth listening to him. Sometimes he'll get you upset, but his audience eats out of his hands. And our student last year, Rabbi Rachman, was made from by Rabbi Hirsch. This is from the chief rabbi of England, Jonathan Sachs. The most personal of festivals. It's taken from his Machzor on Yom Kippur. The man has a golden tongue and a golden pen.
You know, Cohen published a book of all the introductions of his Machzor. So it's all a Pesach and Sukkot.
All together. He has a golden pen. Maybe it's taken from that. This is an article by Yitz Greenberg. Famous article. I saw it a number of times already, where he criticizes the Rav for not walking into open orthodoxy. In other words, the Rav opened the door, but did not walk through the future of modern orthodoxy. The article gets me very upset, but it's worth reading. And he doesn't understand the Rav. The Rav Taka lived in the Western world, but the Rav had demarcation. Ger v'toshav, anochi imachem. This Yitzchak sent me on halakhic approaches of two modern poskim. Did you get my answer? I called yours. I recorded an answer. So very interesting. It's by Rabbi Angel. He's comparing Reb Moshe and Reb David Halevi. But he doesn't realize Reb Moshe. You can't just say one is Mekil, one is Machmir. Reb Moshe in certain areas was also a tremendous Mekil. In Dinei Yishud, in Mamzei Rut, wow, Rav Moshe is way beyond Rav Gorin. This is an interesting article on a letter from the sixth Rebbe to the Rebbe to his Machutenista, meaning the seventh Rebbe's mother. When the seventh Rebbe's mother finally got out of Russia and was in Paris, the sixth Rebbe wrote to her. Interesting. This is the Rebbe influencing a man who later becomes an engineer, and their discussions about engineering and innovation. And again, you see the Rebbe, his breitkeit. New York Times, from Poland to Lithuania, writer's search for her Jewish past. Interesting, she comes to the shtetl, the one Jew left, the one guy who still remembers. This is very interesting. Chabad people are putting out a wedding magazine, and they decided that they can publish pictures of women. Thank God some people are listening to Aaron Rakefet. The greatest tragedy in our world is not to publish pictures of women. We have more sex crimes than ever. A person has to have a healthy attitude. There are women. There is a desire. God created the world. You have to ubachata b'chayim. I don't have to go further. Okay. This is an interesting interview with the chief rabbi of Antwerp, who becomes a Chabadnik, and his outlook on the world, his life, Rabbi Moshe Lieberman. The Battle of Beards, this is true too, very interesting. This goes back to my Talmud in YU in the 60s, who became right-wing and claims every Jew to be from has to have a beard. And he wrote a letter, and Modia, the Agudat Yisrael publication, would not publish his letter, because how can you say that if you don't have a beard, you're not a from Jew? If every yeshiva, Litvish yeshiva boy didn't have a beard, and Rav Moshe, everything we spoke about in class. So here's some of the exchange. Very interesting. A guy named, it's Weiner, I believe it's pronounced. You'll see, it's the whole response, what went on in Rabbi Moshe Weiner. A whole response with the chaplaincy, and can you have a rub with a beard in the American chaplaincy, etc. This is from Haaretz Zion, an update. Anyway, very fascinating, their fundraising ability and the way they live b'shalom v'shalva with so many different opinions there. And we can learn from that. It's very inspiring. That's for Baron Lichtenstein. It's a result of the rub. It's a result of the lotion, what we spoke about today in class. This article is enough to make you commit Harry Carey. It's aggravated me. Unbelievable. Two copies came in to me. This is a graduate of Chovevei Torah. Orthodox rabbi, the host alternative Yom Kippur service in Beer Garden. And this is a graduate of Chovevei Torah, Aaron Potek, in the woods of West Virginia. That's the picture. With a beard, better than Rakefet, if the beard counts. And they're holding a service in a beer garden. Some people fasting, some people not fasting. It's beyond words. So Chovevei Torah, well, we're not officially, yeah, but the problem is this student does that, that student does this. When it's all over, wow, what your students have done to Yiddishkeit. Dr. Edmund Eger, who found a safer way to make anesthesia safer. I only wonder if this isn't a direct descendant of Rabbi Akiva Eger. And I can tell you that this we can't talk about too publicly, but Rabbi Akiva Eger, the only people outside of Balei Tshuva who I taught, either his daughter who married the Chatam Sofer, that's a different, or his grandson, for whom his son had shiva for, because he became a Hasidic Rebbe, Rabbi Leibel Eger, he still has some direct descendants that are Jews and from. Outside of that, well, memories of an anti-Semitic State Department, something that just happened now in the State Department, nothing changes. Feminism, Orthodox women dare to go to mikvah on Yom Kippur Eve like men. It's the whole question. Tell me, did you ever see women full korim in the shul? The first time my wife saw it in Israel. No, lulav and etrog is male, that's minor. But the full korim, my wife couldn't take it. She said, they're too old. She can't go to shul Simchas Torah because they in the Yakar HaShul, they take the thing. Then she goes to my shul and she suffers these. But don't ask. But to my real shul, oh, Rivka. So anyway, women for Kurim, now women want to go to mikvah like men. Why not? I don't know. What an article. This is very tragic. Florida nursing home. You know what happened, right in Hollywood, Florida. 8 people died during the hurricane, and they had no electricity. And right across the street was a hospital that had tremendous generators working. Why didn't they move the people across? But it's not simple, because if you've ever been in a hurricane, and I have, you have no idea what's coming down and the winds and the rain. But very sad. It was not a Jewish home, but there were Jews there, probably among the dead too. This comes back to Chana, and the Rebbe's mother is in Paris, and how the Rebbe is writing to her and going to Paris. It's a whole story of Kibbutz Aviyim. And here, Chabad is putting in hundreds of thousands of dollars. People, they got a collection of primitive videos of Fabrengens in the early 70s, and they're now resprucing them, and you'll be able to see videos of what it was like in the 70s. All right, you got to give Chabad all the credit in the world. I wish we had videos of the Rav's Yotzeit Shia.
There were no videos? At the very end, there are
videos, not at the Tshuva Drasha in the late 70s when the Rav, it's very hard for us to look at that because it's the Rav when he was not well, but it's still, there are parts there that are magnificent when he speaks about Majids and the Shtibel and Motzei Shabbos and all that goes with it. But there's one difference between us and Chabad. Chabad has no Rebbe today. It's all living off the past. If you recall my lectures, they're better off than Breslov, because Breslov has no video clippage of the Rebbe, of their Rebbe. But we at YU, for better or for worse, we went further. I cannot say that we have anyone like the Rav today, with all due respect to the famous names, Rabbi Shechter, Rabbi Rosenzweig, Rabbi Willig, but we go further what we have. And on that, I end off the class with a Maim Chazal. Now give me the Maim I want to quote. Yiftach v'daro, kishmuel v'daro. All right. I want to thank you very, very much for coming to class. Aaron, if you would drag up a few of the fellas, it would make me very, very happy. I can't believe, I don't know if anyone's back. I looked around this morning, it's Nachgeven Shvach, it was weak. But nevertheless, I want to thank you very much, Hakarat HaTov. And I am planning a break in teaching and doing something very different that you do once in a lifetime. But that's in December time, Kislev time. It has to do with a factor of age and everyone bothering me to do this and do that. And I'm an old-fashioned Jew, still a hate. I don't have to make any public scene. Don't want to elaborate further, but I've had too many friends that they honored and did great things and whatnot. And I don't want to mention what happened afterwards. So I'm still a youngster, but you do hit a certain age that I want to be makir taiva to those who share my spirit. And I have in my office a loose leaf filled with a good few hundred pages, if not more, on 5 individuals that had a tremendous impact on me. And when the time comes, I'm stopping teaching the formal classes, and I'm knocking off a week or two Hakarat HaTov to 5 individuals, not talking about their lives and everything else, about some of them I wrote books are written, but my interrelationship with them, what I got from them, how I viewed them. Zev, are you going to be here?
No.
Where are you going? One second, America. How can you live in America?
You can't live in America. No. I have to go there.
Sheva mitzvah, the zilzul. Look what's going on in California. It's not, you have to ask yourself, what's happening? What maybe, I don't know, maybe Chazal are telling the truth when they say the Ribbono Shel Olam said he would never bring a flood on the whole world. And you know what the Makom HaPatish was, according to some Mishkevei Zacha, but he will, but say, I don't want to spell it out. Say that. Anyway, who the five people are? Ask me next week. We'll keep you in suspense. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vidanya.